This interview of Wisdom from the Top was recorded in 2020. From Luminary and Built It Productions, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, Peter Cuneo and the turnaround at Marvel.
It all sounds very sexy now, right? I mean, you look back at Marvel.
Yeah.
You think that there were no days when we were yelling at each other, want to throw each other out the window sometimes.
Right.
You think we just thought this up and we were all brilliant and we all agreed on everything. Hardly. Hardly.
How Peter Cuneo came to be known as the turnaround superhero who led Marvel back from the brink.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So it's hard to imagine now, but in the mid-1980s, Marvel Comics made the vast majority of its money off paper comic books. Now, today, comic books account for a tiny fraction of Marvel's revenue. Movies, merch, and licensing fees have turned Marvel into one of the jewels in Disney's crown. Disney bought Marvel for $4.2 billion in 2009, and it would turn out to be one of Disney's best acquisitions. But just a few years earlier, and this is hard to believe, Marvel was on the brink of bankruptcy. So the company brought in Peter Cuneo to help save it from collapse. And over the course of the next few years, Marvel essentially transformed from a comic books company to a movie company. Today, Marvel films like The Avengers and Spider-Man regularly top the box office. But back when Peter came aboard, the company was struggling to figure out how to use its more than 7,000 characters in ways that could make it profitable. And the choice to even bring Peter to Marvel seemed unusual. After all, his previous experience was running brands like Remington Electric Razors and Clairol hair care products. But Peter was also considered a steady hand. It's a quality he believes he developed as a young officer on a destroyer during the Vietnam War.
Very early, I was new on the ship. We were in the war zone. I had been on the ship a couple of weeks.
Do you remember where you were? Like
off of North Vietnam. And our assignment at that time was what's called plane guarding. When the carriers launch or recover aircraft, they want to have a destroyer or some ship a mile in front and a mile in trail.
Right.
So that if the planes go in the water, God forbid, hopefully we can pick up the pilots. And actually, the worst time for Navy planes was actually launch and landing back on the carrier. The time generally of most stress, believe it or not. Not that there wasn't stress over North Vietnam, but it is now the mid-watch. The mid-watch on a Navy ship generally is from midnight to 4 a.m. I am on the bridge. My only duty is to observe because I'm brand new. I couldn't be more wet behind the ears. We have what's called an officer of the deck in the Navy who is trained and is qualified to drive the ship. Great deal of responsibility. In between the launches, you float around kind of at random, waiting for an encrypted call from the carrier to tell you to take station in front of them or in back of them. My assignment is 1 mile in trail. I got to get to that spot as fast as possible, because if I don't, somebody could go in the water.
Yeah.
And it would be on us for not being on station. So it's now the mid-watch. The captain is asleep in his chair. The captain, when we're in a combat zone, virtually never leaves the bridge except for a few bodily functions.
Right.
And the captain is exhausted. We get an order from the carrier to take station behind them as they turn into the wind to recover aircraft.
Right.
The officer deck does the required calculation, and he gives an order to the helmsman, and we come to flank speed, which is full speed. The captain is groggy. Even though I'm brand new, I can tell something is not right. The captain does his own calculation. He countermands the officer of the deck's orders. The officer of the deck says, "Captain, I think we should do that calculation again." And I know already something is not right because they should not be disagreeing. About 2 minutes later, we look up and we're about to collide with the other destroyer.
Wow.
The captain gives an order of hard right rudder, the only time in my Navy career I ever heard hard rudder.
Does that entire ship just veer hard right? I mean, did you feel it? Everyone on that ship knew what was going on?
At flank speed, when you have that kind of rudder, put the rudder over that hard, the ship actually leans.
Wow.
And it could lean 15 or 20 degrees, even that big ship, because of the momentum. It's just physics.
Yeah.
Anyway, we get on station. And the next day, a ship is like a little town. Everybody knows everything.
Yeah.
The next day, the buzz in the ship is, the captain almost got us killed last night. Can we trust this captain?
Huh.
Is he the leader that we need? Even the officers are questioning. And the captain does something which turns out, in my experience, to be extraordinary. The captain called a meeting of all the officers. And I'm there, just again, sitting and listening. And he starts the meeting by saying, "Last night we had an incident. I made a mistake. And I want to spend the next hour completely analyzing what happened so it never happens again."
Wow.
And I could see, just sitting there in 1 hour, the mood of the officers, and of course they would affect the sailors ultimately, change from, "Can we trust this captain?" to, "We could die for this captain." Because he's telling us, in effect, he cares more about the safety of the ship than his career.
So when he stood up there and he said, "Look, I made a mistake," everyone was sort of stunned to hear that?
Pretty surprised, I'll tell you. And the end of the story is this: that captain eventually made admiral.
Wow.
And, you know, we all have our heroes in life, and that first captain would certainly be one of them for me. And one of these essentials that I live by in leadership and have is the essential about tell people what you really think. Admit your mistakes. Many people think that admitting their mistakes makes them look weak.
Right.
It doesn't. It makes you look human. Now, if you're talking about a mistake every day, that's a different issue, of course. But basically, great leaders are willing to show their human side.
Yeah.
It is very, very important.
So after your time in the Navy, a hugely important time in your young life at that point, someone encourages you to go study business, and you went to Harvard Business School. Did you think of yourself as like that was going to be your life? I'm going to get into business and management?
No. I had a good run in the Navy, and my 3 years of active duty that I was required to serve were coming up. I had just gotten married to my beautiful wife, Maris. The captain came to me and said, "Cuneo, I have good news for you. The Navy wants to offer you a regular commission." So regular commission is what the graduates of Annapolis get.
Right.
And their requirement is 5 years as opposed to the 3 years for reservists. At least that's what it was at the time. And I was thrilled because I love the Navy. Thrilled. But my wife wasn't thrilled. And she said she knew that the life of a ship driver in the Navy is go to sea for 6 months. She doesn't see you. She raises the kids alone. And that wasn't for her. And I had to respect that. She had already been around the ship for 6 months.
You had seen yourself basically maybe having a career in the Navy.
Yes. Hmm. I love the adventure of the Navy. That's really what it came down to. It's that simple. So I went back to the captain and I said to him, "I'm not going to stay in, Captain, but I really appreciate what the Navy is offering." The captain said to me, "So, Cuneo, what are you going to do?" And I said, "I don't really know. I'm going to go to graduate school." He said, "For what?" I said, "I don't know." So he said to me, "Cuneo, you should go to Harvard Business School." Now, he had just gotten his doctorate from Harvard Business School. The Navy is very big on education for its officers. So I said to him the truth. I didn't even know Harvard had a business school, and my self-image does not include me going to the Ivy League. He said to me, "Cuneo, you don't know how good you are." And of course, I just took it at that time as, oh, he's being nice.
Yeah. You know?
So he said, do me a favor, take the business boards, which I did, and I got a very high grade.
Yeah.
And of course, that changed my life. And by the way, my beautiful Maris is now my wife of 48 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, so you go to Harvard Business School, and then you graduate around 1973. And you were at this conglomerate, W.R. Grace, for a few years, I guess, focused on consumer business. And then you went to Bristol Myers Squibb. What did you do there? Like, were you in marketing or were you in sales?
No, I was very much a financial person, involved in accounting, involved in financial planning, involved in capital spending. So I got to get the sweep of a business very quickly, which was very useful. And I learned how to analyze the success or failure of a business, at least from the numbers. Now, there's a lot more to that particular challenge, as you know, than just looking at numbers. But that was the start for me.
You would end up spending, I think, 14 years at Bristol Myers Squibb with different divisions, Clairol, Black & Decker. Did you see yourself when you were there as a lifer?
Yes, I thought that I was good at it. I will say there were times when playing the game of big corporations.
Yeah.
And I was skilled at that game. But deep down inside, I really wanted to know, okay, that's great that I can do this. But, you know, when only 10% of your time is building a business, the rest is politics or dealing with just bureaucracy. I was always interested in back of my mind, you know, maybe I can get something that will be a little different. What happened to me actually, which turned out to be very fortuitous, was that I was thrown into my first turnaround. It was a small division of Clairol.
Which is beauty care, right?
It was,
beauty products.
But there was also an orphan division of Clairol called personal care products like hair dryers, hot rollers, curling irons, foot spas, and so on.
Right. So not a hugely profitable.
No, and
right.
Very controversial. Like many people in corporations say, why are we even in this business?
But yeah, because, I mean, curling irons, the profit margin is not going to be the same as bottles of shampoo, right? Yeah.
Exactly right. But I was tossed into a situation. I was asked to take over the international division. It was a small business doing business, though, in 25 different countries.
Was the question posed to you, Peter, should we shut this down? Or was it, Peter, we need you to save this business?
Yeah. No, there was no shutting down. That was never
discussed.
You had
to save that business.
Right.
Okay. So you didn't have a whole lot of room to maneuver.
No.
So was it a marketing problem? Was it an efficiency problem? What was going on?
It was primarily a leadership problem. I've done 7 turnarounds, and I would tell you that virtually everyone was mostly a leadership problem.
It's not about inefficiency. It's not about bad marketing. It's about managers or management.
Generally speaking, sure, there's some of those other things like poor marketing. But my career has been in businesses that you call creative businesses.
Yeah.
By that, I mean that they were not dependent on technology for success or failure. Competition was not going to come up with a new hair dryer, for example, that was going to blow your product out of the water.
So what was the leadership problem?
It's attitude. The leadership in that case tended to be very omnipotent, was not in touch with the employees. There were a lot of good people in the organization that had not been freed up to really fly. And I had to, over time, find those people. And so once they were given more responsibility and allowed to actually drive some of the business, we started to have success. There was one other very big factor. When you're designing, say, a hair dryer, right, you can imagine your big market is the United States.
Sure.
But then you have all these other countries. Actually, these products were affected by culture. For example, no French woman would ever be seen in hot rollers.
Right.
So you couldn't sell a product there, whereas in the United States, hot rollers were perfectly acceptable.
Sure.
So figuring out what products you could bring to market and what you couldn't was a challenge. And here's the other big factor. A lot of great ideas that had come from other countries into the U.S. for products had been ignored because the organization was simply too U.S.-centric.
Right.
I started saying, this is a great idea from the U.K. this is a great idea from Australia. You know, this is a great idea from Norway. We're going to maybe adapt this for around the world. And that was a big change for the organization. The biggest thing about turnarounds in general is the company or the organization may be bankrupt financially, but they're always bankrupt from a cultural standpoint. The value system of the organization has to be changed.
It's been so torn down, you essentially have to rebuild it from the ground up.
People expect to lose.
Yeah. All right, so you eventually would leave Bristol-Myers Squibb and then spend about 3 years, I guess, on a similar turnaround at Black & Decker. And then 93, you end up at Remington. How did that come back? And by the way, this is a company, I should say, that made the Remington microblade razor, right? As close as your blade or your money back. This was a famous commercial. People probably remember that. What was going on at the company in 1993?
Victor Kiam, who was the father of advertising that was what we used to call CEO advertising.
Right.
The CEO
His face was on TV.
Yeah. No leader, no CEO had ever been willing to actually put their face on advertising before.
And it was largely a successful company for a while, right?
For a while. Yeah, definitely.
Was there competition from straight razors, from other electric razors? What was happening?
There's that competition. There's always. But I think what had happened is that Victor had some setbacks financially with the New England Patriots.
He bought the New England Patriots.
Yes.
Because he just loved football. And so
I don't know the details, actually. Yeah. His deal may not have been as lucrative as it might have been.
Right. But how did that affect Remington? I mean, it's a separate thing.
Well,
right?
Because he was having financial reverses there, he had used his ownership of Remington as collateral on loans to buy the Patriots.
Right.
So the banks are saying, well, wait a minute. This is an issue. And then he was spending a lot of time on that and less on Remington. And Remington started to
really decline.
To decline.
So what happened? Did you get a call from him or
somebody? Yeah, so I had known Victor. Believe it or not, I had done a joint venture. We had sold Remington Shavers in Germany when I took over my first turnaround, which was the—
At Bristol-Myers.
Right, right.
Okay. How close were they at that time to bankruptcy?
The company was strained. The company, you might argue, was in virtual bankruptcy, not legal bankruptcy, if you looked at the kind of loans they had and what have you. It was just felt we needed somebody to come in that had, you know, could put full time in on the job. And I had been on the board, so they asked me to do it.
What attracted you to the job? I mean, was it a challenge?
Yes. At this point, I have to tell you, I am now officially addicted to turnaround challenges.
Right.
I enjoyed doing them. I had had success. I also will tell you that my sense of risk coming back from the Navy in Vietnam was very different than most human beings. You're going to make a lot of people unhappy, and the outcome is uncertain. And initially, everybody's scared every day that works in the company. So it's not for everybody.
So what were some of the things that you had to do to stop the bleeding?
Well, the advertising was a factor. Victor had been advertising, as you described very well, for many, many years with no change. Essentially the same advertisement. The product he was holding up was the same product from 6 or 7 years before.
All right. So you get to the company and I'm assuming you have to make cuts. You have to cut staff.
So the biggest change was moving manufacturing to Asia.
Because it was being made in Bridgeport,
Connecticut.
Right.
And we didn't move every product, but we moved the products that made the most sense. And, of course, that meant there were less jobs in manufacturing, less American jobs. I often, though, when I hear politicians, even today, talking about moving jobs back and forth and we're going to retain jobs, the reality of some of these jobs is really very simple. If you want to save the company and all the jobs, so I would argue at Remington I saved most of the jobs, but not all. You're going to have to adapt. Your competition is already in Asia. This was the case at Remington.
Right.
Making competitive products at the same quality with far less cost.
Like these are like Asian manufacturers, Norelco and other brands.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. You basically have to go there. There was that aspect. And of course, our costs went down substantially and we became much more competitive.
Right. You were there again 3 years. This is starting to sound like a pattern. 3 years, 2.5, 3 years. In that three-year time period, you essentially helped to sell this company to a group of private equity investors. I think you sold the company for about $225 million. Was that a good deal for Remington? Was it? Did everybody walk away with some money?
Sure. You're going from a company that is losing money, so potentially has almost no value,
yeah,
to $225 million in 3 years later. And so
was Victor happy with that outcome?
Victor was happy, but I also always thought that he, you know, the idea that he was no longer associated with Remington
was hard for him.
Was very hard
sure,
for him.
Sure, because it was his baby.
Yeah, but if you run the numbers, he made about $100 million.
So he did
On the sale, yeah. As did his partner, Ike Perlmutter. So that's another reason, you know, I got called to go to Marvel.
And this is your bridge to Marvel. My question was going to be, how do you go from a, you know, electric razor company to the biggest comic book company, but it's this guy Perlmutter.
Yeah.
Perlmutter was the co-founder or the co-partner of Remington. He sees what you've done there and he says to you what? Peter, I'm an investor in Marvel? Like, how is he connected to Marvel?
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Ike Perlmutter had a number of different companies, including Remington. And
that he would seed or he would invest in?
That he, yeah, and ran. And one was actually a Canadian toy company called Toy Biz that he had bought in bankruptcy. So Ike at one point had acquired the rights to make all the Marvel toys.
Wow.
Okay. And so when Marvel went into bankruptcy, any contract can be voided if it helps save the company.
Yep.
So basically his right to make Marvel toys could completely disappear, which was a very big, important part of his business.
He would lose a lot of money.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So Ike wanted to basically bring Marvel out of bankruptcy himself.
All right, let's pause for a sec because I want to go back just a couple of years to set the scene. What happened at Marvel? I mean, we're talking about the biggest characters in modern history, right? The biggest superheroes, Spider-Mans and Iron Mans and Black Panthers and so on. Why does Marvel find itself in bankruptcy in 1999?
Well, because the bubble in comic books had long passed.
So
in comic books was in the early 90s.
Let me make this clear for people. The bulk of Marvel's income in the 1990s came from comic books, from physical comic books?
Yes.
It's just hard to imagine. So Marvel was primarily a publishing house, essentially.
That's correct. Yes. They had not made any films at that point.
In the 90s, there were no Marvel films?
No, there were one or two very poor films made that in one case, for example, the company actually went to the producer and bought the movie because it was so bad and they didn't want to put out.
But DC was making movies. There was Batman and there was – so wait, why wasn't Marvel making movies in the 90s when the DC characters were
– I can't – I don't know.
Okay. So when we think of Marvel today, you think of a media company basically. This was not really – it was essentially a publishing house that also had some licensing deals for toys. Mr. Perlmutter owns a toy business as a licensing deal with Marvel, and he sees Marvel's going under, and he's thinking, holy, you know what? I'm going to lose this opportunity to make these toys. So he calls Marvel and he says, hey, I have someone for you?
No. After a 2-year bankruptcy, he succeeded in getting the judge in the case to accept his plan for the company going forward.
So he had to basically.
And so he brought Marvel out of bankruptcy.
He becomes the biggest shareholder in the company.
Yes.
He has to presumably buy a significant chunk of the company. And he says, Peter, I need you to come here and do what you did at Remington.
Yes.
All right. When you got to Marvel in 1999, were you a comic book fan? Did you know anything about comics? Nothing. You were just you were a business guy. You were not a
– I didn't know anything about the comic.
Did you even know who Stan Lee was?
Vaguely.
Was he there?
Yes. Stan was there, but he was chairman emeritus.
Right.
He was not an
active role.
Yes, yes.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
All right, so you've got a bankrupt company, but...
We're out of bankruptcy.
Out of bankruptcy.
Technically now out of bankruptcy.
Which is really actually one of the worst places to be because no one wants to, right? You got no cash.
Good people leave.
You've got no money.
Well, we came out of bankruptcy. You do have a new financing. The reality is most of the time these capital structures coming out of bankruptcy are almost as bad as what you had when you went in.
All right. So your core product that was fueling the business for the last previous decades, comic books, that was not going to be your future. You knew that.
Correct. So let me tell you what happened. I was on the job about 6 months. I knew nothing also about making movies. The movie business was actually the brainchild of a guy named Avi Arad. He was a big partner in Marvel. And Avi had moved to California to get us into more films. And I would love to tell you that this was my idea, but it was not at all. He deserves the credit for driving that.
Okay, let's just break this down a little bit because I think what you're getting at is the future of Marvel was going to be in films, in entertainment. It was not going to be in comic books, printing comic books, right?
No, the future was going to be in all of the above. So okay. Let me give you a sense of the model that I had in my head.
Yep.
I would like you to think of a wagon wheel. And in the middle is the hub. And the hub is your intellectual property. It's your brands. And in the case of Marvel, I considered Spider-Man a brand.
Sure.
The Hulk a brand. I looked at them just like I'd looked at other brands
and
other businesses.
At shampoos and at curling irons.
Yeah.
And,
you
right.
had a long-range okay. plan for them, right. how to grow them,
yep.
how to monetize them, and so on. That's your IP. And then you have various spokes. And the spokes are either media forms that you're participating in, or consumer product categories that you're participating in. In the case of Marvel, it would be generally by licensing.
And that would be toys and
right.
games
right.
and...
Okay. Right. So what did we okay. have when I was 6 months in? We only had two businesses.
What were they?
We had the comic book business.
Okay.
So call that the print media spoke.
Right.
We're in the toy business because Ike Perlmutter's toy company... Print media, toys, and a little bit of other licensing. That's it. It's a very shaky wheel.
Yeah.
Now, the rim of the wheel is the synergy between all the spokes. So if you think about Marvel today, if you go to the movies, you're going to buy toys for your kids. You might get them back-to-school products or confectionery. You're going to play the video games. If you play the video games, you're going to go to the movies. It's all intertwined now. But at that time, we had only two spokes.
And you've got Avi Arad, who's starting to look into movie potential. First of all, to make movies is very expensive. I'm assuming you didn't have any cash to build a movie studio. So did you just go to a movie company and say, hey, you guys can make this movie for us?
Yes. So Avi had started relationships with a number of the major studios. And in fact, those did play out as time went on. For example, X-Men 1 came out in 2000.
Right.
We had done that with Fox. Spider-Man 1 came in 2001. We did that with Sony, right. Columbia Pictures. Hulk 1 came out the next year. We did that with Universal.
And did Marvel make a lot of money off those?
We actually did okay, considering we invested zero funds.
Right.
Not a penny.
You just gave
we got a share of the revenues.
Right. Okay. But the movie studios are getting the bulk of that.
Yes.
I read that at one point in 2000, Marvel had $3 million in the bank, which was barely enough to cover its needs. The stock price was like down to 96 cents a share, something like that. Okay, you've got some of these movie things are moving forward, but I have to assume you had to create a plan for how to move forward.
Sure, yeah.
What is the plan that you sort of lay down?
Well, let's start with the capital structure. We really cleaned up the capital structure. And then look, the movies just exploded.
Yep.
I think many people do not appreciate the power of the comic book community. Comic book community influences popular culture in many ways, not yeah. just comic books. You see it more today now.
Yeah.
Their opinions on quality or not quality really matter. And so for X-Men, which at the time was Marvel's, I think, most popular comic book, still 1% or less of the population in the United States is in the comic book world.
Wow.
Yet the film premiered on a Friday morning. So Friday at midnight, the lines were around the block at movie theaters.
Wow.
And when people start to hear that, they say, you know what? I don't know anything about people, even X-Men, they didn't even know it was a comic book. And yeah. had no idea.
Yeah.
I got to see that movie.
Yeah.
And that's how it started.
From what I understand, right, the real turnaround happened when Marvel decides to produce the movies itself, to actually invest money in building out a facility to make the movie, instead of going to the big movie houses, to essentially become a movie house.
We were doing quite well, even without that change. However, in 2005, and this is, again, I want to give credit to somebody else on this. In 2005, I was actually vice chairman of the board.
You become vice chairman, I think, in 2003. You sort of lead the turnaround, and then you hand the reins off to a new
right.
team, and you
exactly.
became vice chairman.
I became vice chairman.
Right, okay.
So we had a guy named David Maisel who had a dream that we could create our own studio, and there was a lot of skepticism
sure.
in the company and in the investment community. How the hell can Marvel suddenly create a studio right. like the big – we had made something like 14 films before we started talking about our own studio. And we had, in effect, apprentices because we were not just walking away. We were on the set every day. And you basically can hire the same talent the studios do. They're all freelance, in effect. They come in for a project. And when the project's completed, they get paid and leave.
Yeah.
And by having our own studio, we could keep all the money for ourselves instead of splitting it with the studio partner.
Yeah.
And in fact, we were able through a lot of efforts, including David's, to raise a little over $500 million to fund the studio in a deal that will never be repeated again in the motion picture business because we gave away no equity.
Huh.
But the reason we're able to do this is we had the greatest track record in the history of film as measured by average global box office.
Hmm.
Nobody was close. And we had this lineup. Marvel has 7,000 characters.
Yeah.
And the A-list might be 12 characters. We made films from the A-list, maybe half of those characters. So there's a lot more to go. And then there's the lenders saw that as great potential.
I mean, it's hard to believe that Marvel, I mean, Avengers, the X-Men, I mean, Black Panther, Iron Man, all these characters, no one was making movies with them in the 80s and 90s.
I think there's a number of reasons for that. One, the films that had been made way back, 70s, 80s, tended to be very campy. Men in Tights, we often call them, Men in Tights movies. The special effects did not exist. The computer-generated imagery technology did not exist. They were you know, just not very good films.
Yeah.
But there was a film that changed everything, I think, that people often talk about. And that was Terminator 2 with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
The guy that he's fighting against was this flowing metal.
Yeah.
And that was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Now we can actually make films where characters have powers and they do things.
10 years after this bankruptcy, Marvel sells to Disney for $4.5 billion, which was a blockbuster deal at that time, although today it was probably worth probably at least twice that amount.
Or more.
Or more. Disney's done very, very well with that franchise. I mean, right, 7,000 characters. Every movie is guaranteed to be one of the four or five biggest movies of the year. I mean, you are essentially today printing money if you own a comic book company. Do you, when you sort of reflect on all these different points in your career and these different turnarounds, I can't help but thinking that if you were giving somebody advice, you might almost say to them, go to a failing company. There's really nowhere to go except up. Is that fair to say?
You know, it all sounds very sexy now, right? I mean, you look back at Marvel.
Yeah.
Do you think that there were no days when we were yelling at each other, want to throw each other out the window sometimes?
Right.
Or you think we just thought this up and we were all brilliant and we all agreed on everything? Hardly. It seems so pat now looking back, but none of these turnarounds were. None of them. I would say to my wife on many of them in the first 6 months, and she would tell you this. I'd come home and say, I think I made a major career blunder. Now, they all worked out.
Right.
You can make a lot of money. That's the great part of this. But it's not easy. It's not for everybody.
You have a list that you talk about, 32 essentials of turnaround leadership. They're super valuable and helpful. But, I mean, you really could apply this to a small organization, the PTA or a school board. I mean, you could really apply this to big and small organizations. So let me – I want to ask you about a couple of them. I mean, one of them is a lesson that you say, never think I've seen it all before, right? Which I think a lot of people would assume that would be your approach. You saw this failing and the turnaround. Then you went to this company and you've seen that. You've seen the bad morale. You've seen the same thing they get to Marvel. Yeah, I've seen this before. But you're saying you actually haven't seen it all before.
No, definitely not. I mean, you may have walked into the same kind of climate. But in terms of the solutions, in terms of the people, it's always different. It's a huge mistake to think that you're so good that there's pat answers to, particularly in turnarounds.
How do you find the people when you get to a failing company, when you're an outsider, who are going to level with you and really tell? Because a lot of people are scared. You might fire them. You might have to get rid of them. You have to have downs, whatever it might be. How do you get people to tell you really what's going on, the truth?
By telling them the truth. So if you're having a town hall meeting, which is all the employees are there, and someone says, are we going to have layoffs? You tell them the truth, which is we might. I don't know right now. I have no plans right now for layoffs. And people begin to trust what you say. You're going to make changes in leadership. There's no question about that. There are various ways to find out who has the mentality to handle a situation where, as I said before, there's great uncertainty. And who can't? You also find out who are the true team players and who aren't. And you're going to find those gems that I mentioned in the organizations that when they're freed up, really
fly. They really perform.
And then, yes, you're going to have to bring in some new people as well. And when you bring in new people, you have to test them to make sure that they can handle this kind of emotional situation.
One of the things you talk about is creating a new culture, right? You go to a failing company, you have to assume that there is a cultural problem. There may have been a strong culture at one point in the company's history, but they lost their way. And so your job is to create a new culture. Not easy, especially when you go into a company with a strong culture. It may have a negative culture, but it's probably pretty strong. And there's going to be a lot of resistance to creating a new culture. How do you do that?
Well, again, I think it's all about espousing certain fundamental principles that you actually live by, again, in your own actions. People are going to be watching you very closely. You know, every day you're on stage. I hate to say it, but there is that element. And what you say and how you act, and if you say, You know, we're going to have an organization that recognizes diversity, and you have one of your direct reports only hiring people of a certain color, you have to make a change.
Yeah.
Things where people are misbehaving and your new culture is we're just not putting up with that. You have to do something. And I've had people arrested
for
misbehaving. That certainly makes an immediate impact on the company. There's other things, too. Somebody comes in with a new advertising campaign and it's average and you say, okay, well, you've lost people. I would often go into a turnaround and cut the advertising budgets. And then I would say to marketing people, okay, so we need to have just as much impact or more than we had before.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would say, if you're cutting my advertising budget, how can I have more impact? And here's the reality. It's really very simple. You come up with a great advertising campaign, a breakthrough advertising campaign.
You said something earlier that really struck me, which is that in every single case of a turnaround, it's not the product that's the central problem. It's not the marketing. It's not the efficiencies or inefficiencies. It is the management. And so you can change the product or you can change the marketing, but if the leadership is not strong, the product isn't going to survive.
The way you change the marketing is by having strong leadership. It isn't change the marketing, then strong leadership.
Yeah.
It's strong leadership, then change the marketing.
Yeah. I like this one. Embrace true emotional maturity. Essentially, what you're saying is that if you're going to be a leader, you have to accept that you're not going to make everyone happy. You're going to have to do stuff that is going to make people upset, and you can't worry about their opinions.
Yeah, I think if you're doing turnarounds or any leadership position where it's not radical, but you have to make change, you're going to find people who will be unhappy. It could be as severe as you're laying someone off or firing someone for cause. On the other extreme, it could simply be someone who had a point of view on a particular issue. You decided to go in a different direction, and in their minds, they didn't win. I will tell you that I have scars from the turnarounds.
What do you mean?
There's people out there today, if you ask them about me,
they hate you.
They will give you a very poor report.
Because ruin their life, they'll say, or something like that.
I don't know if they go that far, but yes, they say this is a bad guy.
And how do you feel about that?
I would love everyone to be happy, but deep down in my heart, I don't care at all. No, I have to be honest.
A part of you doesn't feel a little bit, I don't know, wounded that somebody really feels that way about you?
No, because I have that emotional edge or maturity that you know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so it is what it is.
I
can't change it.
So there may be people out there who are going to, you've been in business for a long time, who are going to say negative things about you that's not abnormal, who might say, oh, Peter Kuhne is the worst guy, he's horrible, he's so cruel. But you feel like every decision you made was made based on an honest assessment. It was not personal. It was something you had to do.
Let me start by saying I think that any decision you make in business is personal. There's no such thing as not being personal. You know what I'm getting at here.
Sure.
But I certainly will never argue that every decision I made was the right decision. My attitude has always been, once I realize they're a mistake, go fix it. It's a little bit like the captain. We talked about the captain on the ship. I made a mistake.
Sure.
Well, it's not going to happen again.
Yeah. What about, this is interesting, if possible, make changes all at once. So you come in and you just basically throw everything into the
pot. Yeah. Well, I have to be honest with you. That is one is almost impossible to actually accomplish.
Right.
I think what I'm trying to do, express on that one, is that you really don't want to wait. When there are certain decisions you know you're going to make, don't find an excuse to wait a month or wait for some more research on some topic. Go and do it because people are waiting. Don't drag it out. A lot of leaders I've dealt with often will do things that allow them almost to blame other people for a decision so that they don't be unpopular. One typical thing is you bring on a consulting company, and you know what their answer is going to be when you throw the problem at them. But you can now say to people, well, so-and-so and so
and we gotta
said this is what we got to do. That's a form of cowardice.
Did you bring consulting companies in when you ran businesses?
Very rarely. I didn't bring them in on strategy because that's my job.
Sure.
That's senior management as a group. That's
you
a
are
job.
The consultant.
The board's job. Yeah. I wouldn't bring them in on that. Strategy actually is not that hard. It really isn't. Not in the businesses I've been in,
yeah.
which are creative businesses, non-technically sensitive businesses. But if there's something that I didn't have any background in, and this happens occasionally on turnarounds where I just have no background on a particular area, then you bring in someone for that to help you with that.
Yeah.
But not for general stuff that's really just my job.
I mean, there's some CEOs who are, you know, they're in it for the long haul. Bob Iger and some of the Hubert Joly who's been on the show from Best Buy. And I mean, they love being CEOs. They love being managing big organizations for a long time. Is it fair to say that that is not, A, what you like to do, B, your strong suit, that really you are an expert in coming in, figuring out how to save a company, how to put out the fire. There's a fire, you got to put it out. And then you move on to another company, that really being a long-term CEO is not really your area of expertise?
Absolutely. I would never hire me to run a good company. I think I know what I'm good at and so on. And yeah, my average length of time on a turnaround has been about 3 years. And that's at the time when you start to feel, you know, if I get run over by a truck tomorrow, the company will be just fine.
Yep. And so your strong suit is really saving the company, putting it back on the right track.
Let someone else.
And then handing the reins out to somebody else.
Yes.
Do you think that leadership is something that you just inherited naturally and knew how to do from a young age? Or do you think it's something that you learned and something that most people can learn, your essential lessons? Do you think it's a learned skill or is it a natural innate thing?
Not at all. I think this phrase about natural born leader is very misleading. It doesn't exist in reality. No one is born naturally as a leader. You learn it from life's experiences. You learn it from how you're raised. You learn it from taking risks. Some of the risks won't work out, but some will. That's where you learn a lot about yourself, if you're honest with yourself. When I was 8 years old and my father was called up to go into the Korean War, we went and lived in several different cities as part of that. We were in the South, we were in the Northwest, and we were in San Diego. And even as an eight-year-old, I could see that there were differences in America, regional differences in how people thought. So already, I was learning at a very young age that, hey, going to have to cope with different situations. I didn't know anything really about leadership, but it started there for me.
So fair to say that you learned how to become a leader?
Absolutely.
Your last lesson in turnaround leadership is know when it's time to go. Clearly, you followed this. You've known when it's time to go and to be comfortable with it, I guess, to just make peace with it.
Yeah, so at Marvel, after 3 years, I went to them and said, I think it's time for me to go. My self-image, at least in that particular area, is pretty accurate. I know when I'm going to start to get bored, won't be as effective, and it's time for a change.
These days, Peter Cuneo runs a company with his sons that invests in consumer media and entertainment companies. One recent project, a comic book company that they took from bankruptcy to a $100 million acquisition. And like a lot of us, he's busy working on a podcast where he'll be talking about those 32 fundamentals of leadership. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary and Built It Productions.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.